Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU and Well Brothers and Sisters. I think that last song, which is Garbage, Stupid Girl, that last song pretty much expresses how I feel about the positions of these leftist organizations I talked about in the Greenville Post article. You know, those organizations that support regime change in Syria. You know, not to mention Amy Goodman on this particular issue. Collaboration with imperialism is something no leftist or progressive should ever do. And when they do it, it deals a blow to every kind of progressive change. Collaboration with the system of imperialism and capitalism, it's like, will inevitably hollow out and destroy any progressive cause you can think of. And especially in a case like this, where, of course, you're basically advocating the destruction of another society. You know, advocating the destruction of a whole nation. I mean, collaborating with imperialism. It's a horrific thing. But another thing that the article in the Grenville Post mentions, one of the things it highlights, is the truth that this war was effectively manufactured outside Syria. And I really cannot stress that enough. That the Syrian conflict, which is so often described as a civil war, somehow arising within Syria, totally dependent on internal factors. In fact, this conflict was foreign-made. It was manufactured outside of Syria and imposed on Syria from the outside. I mean, that political crisis in 2011 that saw protests and which led to the major democratic reform of the country's constitution did not have to become a war. And in contrast to the Western media's repeated lies, it was not the Syrian government that caused it to become a war. That caused it to escalate like that. The Egyptian government killed far more people in street demonstrations in 2011 than the Syrian government did. And yet today there is no war consuming hundreds of thousands of Egyptian lives. No, this was a war made outside of Syria and imported very, very deliberately by the CIA, the U.S. government and its regional allies, primarily Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel. They gave the insurgents guns, they gave them training, they gave them billions of dollars worth of aid, imported legions of foreign fighters from just about every continent. I mean, literally every continent besides Antarctica, and completely prepared the ground for the rise of groups like the so-called Islamic State and the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Nusra Front. Completely paved the way for them, you know, to the tune of billions of dollars. You know, in logistical support, weapons, training, you name it. This was an imperialist war of aggression from the start. And the destruction of a sovereign nation by proxy. A sovereign nation that was founded on an anti-colonial ideology of Arab unity, and which has historically defied U.S. hegemony in the region. This made it a target. This made Syria a target, just as Venezuela and Cuba are targets because of their defiance of American hegemony in Latin America. And North Korea for its defiance of American hegemony in East Asia. And the media, of course, has played its role and played it very well in demonizing Syria as a rogue state. Demonizing it as a rogue state, just like it did with Iraq, and its reporting on the alleged use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government, without any real evidence, and with seriously corrupt sources, very nearly did clear the way for an Iraq War 2.0. There's nothing new about these kind of tactics. It's classic imperialism at work. It's classic propaganda at work. And so I'd like to play a short song about that. A song that was originally sung by a group of IRA prisoners actually being held in a jail, British jail in Northern Ireland in the 1980s. And It expresses profound solidarity with all the victims of imperialism, wherever they may be, understanding that they all face a common foe. And they have to unite against that foe. The song's called Monsters, Devils, and Strangers. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The monsters came just the other day. Thought it was a dream. Rain, fire, causing pain. Heard the children scream. Eagles thundered from the midnight sky. Death beneath their wings. Found their prey in sleepy streams. From Star Wars King. Met the devil in a dusty lane, close by crossroads town. Saw the gleam in his fiery eyes, as flames danced all around. No hope for black when the white man holds the key. No freedom without guns. Break the chains, rise up and ease, put the devil on the run. Freedom's day has come. Silhouettes in a Belfast night. Dark figures stalk the streets. Bringing pain or plastic bullets out to every kid that he meets. Strangers' laws and strangers' ways can never hold us down. Risen hearts with freedom's cry, resistance is all around. Death knell for the crown.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that of course was Bic, Monsters, Devils, and Strangers. Of course, a group of prisoners in a Northern Irish jail composed that, and they sang that. And I believe, if I recall, the message of solidarity there extends to people who. This was written in the 1980s, so of course, like, you had people in Nicaragua resisting U.S. imperialism there, you had people in South Africa fighting against apartheid, and you had people in Northern Ireland resisting British imperialism there and colonialism. And that song tied together the struggles of those three groups of people against imperialism and expressed the solidarity there. And I think it's very important to point out, like, really what anti-imperialism means, because of course, one of the things that these humanitarian interventionists in Syria, like a lot of the things that that really certain Western leftists mistook as legitimate forms of resistance, You know, they assumed that there was the Syrian revolution led by armed groups that were progressive, and they were fighting against this oppressive Syrian government. They should be supported by the West, and the West should intervene and support them, and this was a noble cause, and this sort of stuff. They assumed that this was like the resistance in South Africa. This was like the resistance in Palestine. This was like struggles like that, when of course it was nothing of the sort. These were basically almost foreign back mercenaries who were devastating Syria. They were not a legitimate progressive fighting force. They were not fighting for a progressive revolution. They were not doing anything of the kind. These people were, you know, just like the Contras were in Nicaragua. These guys are basically a CIA army, supported by the CIA, trained by the US, trained by the West, armed by them. And with a terrible reactionary political agenda that wants to smash the rights of women, wants to eliminate the progressive gains of the Syrian people that they've won since colonialism was overcome in that country, and really just completely turn back the clock on Syria's development. I mean, wherever these people have taken control, they've committed atrocities, and they've just, like, you know, brutalized and oppressed the people. These are not people who should be supported. And they're doing it with foreign support, with foreign backing for a imperialist agenda, basically. That's what's going on in Syria. It's not progressive. There's nothing progressive about it. So, I mean, that's what really needs to be understood. And so people like Gilbert Achcar and people like Amy Goodman and all these sort of people who glorify the, you know, these Syrian rebels as being something they're not. You know, these CIA-backed thugs as being somehow heroes. I mean, like, it's disgusting when they do that. Now, in a little while, I'm going to play a talk by Canadian writer Stephen Gowans about his recent book called Washington's Long War on Syria, explaining the history of the conflict and the long history of Western intervention in the country. But first, I want to play this Press TV interview with London-based writer and activist Catherine Shakdam, director of the, I think I'm pronouncing this properly, Shafakna Institute for Middle Eastern Studies, who is another person who has bravely spoken the truth on Syria and consistently confronted the warmongering propaganda machine of the Western media. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that now.
Meanwhile, an advisor to the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, says the war in the country is almost over. Bathana Shaban stressed that the conflict has reached its penultimate stage as foreign countries have cut their support for anti-government militants. She added that her country is on the brink of reconstruction. Shaban said once the terrorists are defeated, Damascus will fight any, quote, illegitimate presence on Syrian land, be it the United States or Turkey. The Syrian army has managed to recapture considerable swaths of land from foreign-backed militants and terrorist groups in recent months. Well, the gains gave the Syrian government the upper hand to bring further peace and stability to a country ravaged by over six years of war. I'd like to welcome Catherine Shakdam, director of Shafakna Institute for Middle Eastern Studies. Ms. Shakdam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, tell us about that. I mean, it is amazing in itself that we've finally gotten to that point that top individuals in the Syrian government are now saying we're on the edge of the end of this devastating war.
Most definitely. I think it's very positive indeed to see that Syria is actually regaining control of its territory, but beyond that has managed to deal a blow to terrorism in general. And I think that it's going to inspire many nations across the region to, you know, to do just that, to do the same and you know, rally around their government and their own sovereignty and push back against, you know, those foreign powers who continue to this day to actually back terrorism. What I found very interesting is that, you know, Dr. Shaban actually made a statement that I think is very relevant, not just to Syria, but again, you know, the region as a whole, as she warned that now that Syria is in control again of its land, of its territory, of its villages, it will go after those who have stood behind terror. Because we need to understand that terror did not just manifest in Syria. It was actually helped, trained, armed, and funded, you know, by foreign powers. So, for example, countries such as Turkey or the U.S. or others in the region, mainly Saudi Arabia, we'll have to answer very difficult questions, and we'll have to face, I think, the wrath of Syria. And I think that Syria here is very much entitled, to its call for vindication, because the Syrian people were denied, you know, the right to political self-determination, the right to their own territoriality, and the right to actually move freely in their land. So we need to understand that terror wasn't made in Syria. It was actually made somewhere else and imported into Syria under the cover of, you know, democratic reforms or revolution and regime change. I think now it's going to be very uncomfortable for great many powers, because the truth is coming to light. And now that the field has cleared up, in a way, militarily speaking, then, you know, I think that questions will be raised, and it would demand answers.
Well, Catherine, really quickly, the significance, though, I mean, if we look at the powers that be that got behind basically regime change in Syria, and we heard them say it across the board, whether it was from the Middle East region to Europe or to the United States. And now, 2017, we're hearing that the Syrian government is on the edge of victory. The overall significance of the resistance and what has been accomplished.
This is the thing. You know, very early on, if you recall, back in 2011, 2012, people laughed, saying that, you know, President Bashar al-Assad had only a few weeks left, in power. What people forgot is that President Bashar al-Assad is not just a man. He was an institution. He represents the sovereignty of Syria. The Syrian people clearly backed him and, you know, gave him legitimacy, because this is who they elected in power. And I think this is the lesson here to be learned, is that you cannot deny a nation, you know, its voice. You cannot deny a nation's its legitimacy, and I mean its sovereign legitimacy. That is very important here. And I think that the resistance movement in Syria has proven just that, is that the real power is with the people. It's not with those, you know, foreign powers who think themselves so mighty that they can dictate the future of a nation or even a region. It doesn't work like this anymore. Do you know, the people of the Middle East may have been, or at least the borders of the Middle East may have been architected by, you know, former, you know, imperial powers, but the reality today has changed. People have, you know, risen above, I would say, whatever differences they had, and now they, you know, they claim themselves, you know, sovereign onto their land.
Okay.
And this is powerful. And what you see today, I don't think it's going to stop just with Syria.
All right, Catherine, I would love to talk to you, and perhaps we will talk more on another program. Appreciate you being with us, Catherine Shakhnam, director of Shafakhna Institute for Middle Eastern Studies out of London.
Hey, back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
This is K-Train Fitzsimmons playing the heavily distorted chromatic harmonica. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
If you had the opportunity to save a life, would you take it? Sounds like a no-brainer, right? And yet only 31% of people in Ontario have registered their consent to donate their organs and tissue in the event of their death. That means, on average, one person will die every 3 days because an organ is not available to save them. By registering, you have the opportunity to save as many as 8 people's lives through organ donation, and to improve the quality of life for up to 75 people through tissue donation. If you want to become a donor, go to beadonor.ca. Take 2 minutes to register your consent to save a life. And don't forget to share your wishes with your family afterwards. In the words of Mike Willis, a very grateful heart recipient,
"If someone hadn't registered their consent to donate, I would not be alive today."
Hey, how you doing? My radio name is Mac D, and I've been hanging around CFRU for a long, long time. Because it's fun. I started off working the equipment, producing shows, and then moved into doing my own show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, Visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR, and to follow up that that talk I just played by Catherine Shockdom, I'd like to play a clip of the Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett, who has just been fearless, absolutely fearless in her reporting of the conflict in Syria, busting through all manner of media lies, particularly surrounding the battle for Aleppo, a city that she herself visited and actually spent a lot of time in during the conflict. And this year, 2017, she did a cross-Canada tour that I'm proud to say that my comrades from the Communist Party of Canada helped facilitate. And this is from when she spoke at a UN press conference in 2016. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On something that Sarah Flounders mentioned, which is that today in the General Assembly, the representative of my country, Canada, has raised a resolution which is not about human rights. It's not about the people of Syria. It's a resolution meant to point fingers and to vilify the governments of Syria and Russia. And this resolution relates to a UN Security Council resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China some days ago. That resolution pertained to another useless ceasefire in Syria, which would have no bearing on, bring no good to the people of Syria, and which follows a week of liberation of areas of Aleppo, which now amounts to about 95% of areas of Aleppo that have been occupied for years by terrorist factions. So at this time, when 100,000 civilians in these areas occupied for years by terrorist factions have been liberated, the UN, parties in the UN wanted to impose another ceasefire. And I want to remind people why these ceasefires are indeed pointless. The last ceasefire in September was from the very start negated by 20 main terrorist factions who declared they were not going to participate, and from the very beginning violated the ceasefire over 300 times during the duration of the ceasefire. And not only these terrorist factions, while the Syrians and while the Russians adhered to the tenets of the ceasefire, but the American-led coalition itself violated the ceasefire by targeting Syrian army positions in Deir ez-Zor, killing at least 83 Syrian soldiers in a prolonged attack that lasted nearly 1 hour and which enabled ISIS to overtake that position. So this is one reason why a ceasefire is pointless at this point in time. There is no faith that any of the parties that the U.S. and Western leaders who have funded these terrorists, there's no faith that they can actually control the terrorists and get them to adhere to a ceasefire. And the people of Aleppo want Aleppo to be completely freed. And I speak having been to Aleppo 4 times, and this is the will of people in Aleppo. So on that note, I'd just like to talk about briefly, I've been to Syria 6 times since 2014, 2 of which were with international delegations, and 4 times were independently on a visa I applied for, paid for, and waited for. My trips have been self-funded or fundraised, and I've gone at my own risk and been able to travel freely in the country to areas I wish to travel to. I've been many times to Homs, to Malula, to Latakia, Tartus, Siaf, Sweida, and again Aleppo 4 times. And I mention these because I think it's important people realize I have, wherever I've gone, I've spoken in Arabic to the people I'm speaking with. What Donna, what Sarah have said, that the people support their army and government is absolutely true. Whatever you hear in the corporate media is the complete opposite. And on that note, what you hear in the corporate media, and I will name them, BBC, Guardian, New York Times, etc., on Aleppo is also opposite of reality. Aleppo since 2012 has been inhabited by different terrorist factions, among them al-Nusra, among them the so-called Free Syrian Army, which has committed the same heinous acts of terrorism as al-Nusra, as ISIS, as Ahrar al-Sham, as Nur al-Din al-Zinki, which beheaded a 12-year-old Palestinian child, and somehow is still deemed moderate. Since 2012, these areas of Aleppo, which have now recently been freed, Their occupation by these terrorist factions has meant the greater Aleppo, the 1.5 million plus population of greater Aleppo, have suffered sieges denying them food and medicine. They've suffered for years a want of electricity and water, and they've suffered daily bombardment by these terrorists of mortars, of gas canister bombs, which are improvised and made locally, of water heater bombs, which are even more powerful and can level floors of entire buildings, of conventional weapons like Grad rockets supplied by the West, and et cetera. As I said, they've suffered these attacks on a daily basis, and even now, because there are still Western-backed terrorists in pockets of Aleppo, there are still mortars and gas canister bombs raining down, and people are still dying in Aleppo. This is another reason why the liberation and securing of these areas is imperative, because that will actually bring peace to Aleppo. Now, my colleagues here mentioned the nature of unity in Syria and the fact that Syrians see themselves first as Syrian before any sect. This is an important point because our media and the Gulf media has made Syria out to be sectarian, which is something the Syrians themselves have denied. But it's a tool to make people confused. It's a tool to make people believe that it's Sunnis against Bashar al-Assad, when in fact, bear in mind that Aleppo is overwhelmingly Sunni and is with the government and is with the army and is suffering from the terrorists who declare that they are liberating the city in Syria. Other points about Aleppo are hospitals in Aleppo have been attacked. I'm sure you've heard in the media that hospitals have been attacked. Well, this media is referring to the pockets of Aleppo that were occupied by terrorists. And they have manufactured stories, and I can give you a precise account. In April of this year, there was a hospital called the Al-Quds Hospital, which in a concerted effort, all media said was attacked and targeted and badly damaged by either the Syrians or the Russians. In fact, the Russians had satellite imagery showing that this hospital was in the same shape that it was in October 2015. No difference. Therefore, it was not attacked. Months later, The Guardian, which is a prominent British newspaper, actually said the Al-Quds hospital that it had alleged months prior to be attacked and destroyed was treating victims of so-called chemical weapons attacks. So even the media that is lying is inconsistent in their lies. But there have been hospitals attacked. I went to the Al-Dabit hospital, which is in Aleppo City. It's a maternity hospital. It was attacked on May 3rd, and three women were killed. You would think this would be something raised at the UN or by so-called human rights groups, but it was not. In December 2013, the Kindi Hospital was attacked and destroyed. It was the largest and best cancer treatment hospital in the Middle East. It was destroyed by al-Nusra terrorist truck bombings. And in fact, in recent media reports on Aleppo, again alleging Syrian or Russian strikes on hospitals, Fox News actually had the audacity to use a photo of Al-Kindi Hospital and allege that this is in eastern areas of Aleppo and that this hospital had been attacked by Syrian or Russian strikes. This goes to show how much the media has been lying from the very beginning about Syria and continues to lie. When I went to Aleppo, I spoke with the Aleppo Medical Association. They comprise 4,160 active and registered doctors. More lies in the media have said the last doctor in Aleppo, the last pediatrician in Aleppo. Of these over 4,000 doctors, 800 of them are specialists. So you can see that when the media talks about Aleppo, it's talking about areas that were occupied by terrorists. And it's completely negating the suffering and the will of the Syrian people in Greater Aleppo. When I was in Aleppo in July, I got a taste of some of the bombings by these terrorist factions. There was an explosion about half a kilometer away at Hattab Baghdad, and I don't know how many people were killed that day, but it was close enough that it was a massive plume of smoke. About 5 minutes later, an explosive bullet fired from an area occupied by terrorists landed about 15 meters away from where I was. If it had hit parked cars, I wouldn't be here speaking. A day later, a good friend of mine, his mother, was killed by one such explosive bullet. So this is just a small taste of what people are suffering on a daily basis. In November, when I was there with a delegation of Western journalists, including from the New York Times, LA Times, BBC, etc., on November 3rd, there were a series of attacks throughout the day with Grad missiles, explosive vehicles, and other explosive bullets and snipings. By the end of the day, 18 people, civilians, were murdered and over 200 were injured, including critically. We were at the Al-Razi Hospital, which is one of the main hospitals, and we saw the maimed people pour in. And this was just one day of many of endless days in Aleppo. On November 4th, we were at the Castello Road Humanitarian Crossing. This was a day that was meant to allow the people in eastern areas of Aleppo that were inhabited by terrorists to evacuate. And this was not the first time. On prior occasions, the Syrians and the Russians had opened 8 humanitarian corridors to enable people to leave. These were attacked by terrorist factions heavily. Even that day on November 4th, the Castello Road crossing was attacked twice with mortar shelling when we were there and 5 times afterwards. Clearly, there has been political will and intent by the Syrian government and its Russian allies to enable civilians to leave, to minimize any sort of loss of human life. Clearly, the terrorists that declare themselves liberators of Syria do not want people to leave. They've been holding civilians hostage. And if you're following reports that are not BBC and that are not New York Times, you will see countless testimonies of civilians, of the 100,000 civilians who've been liberated the last week, saying, thank God for the Syrian Arab army that liberated us. And the terrorists were hoarding food. They were preventing us from having food. This is all documented. Also documented are that areas in these areas occupied by terrorists, including a school, were housing chemicals used to make chemical weapons. And you could see also the gas canisters that were used to make explosive gas canister bombs. In fact, even when I was in Leir Amun, we saw a factory in one of the buildings that was used to make gas canister bombs. In Leir Amun, we also saw evidence of the so-called Free Syrian Army that some people say doesn't exist anymore. The 16th Brigades was active there. They had a cell underground, 3 stories below, that was perfectly intact in spite of aerial bombings above ground. And I make this point because people talk about the destruction in Aleppo as if the physical destruction matters. It's the people that the Syrian government and the Syrian people care about. And the destruction in areas occupied by terrorists occurs because the terrorists are bunkering below ground, come up above ground, fire their bombs on civilian populations, and go back below ground. So I just want to address a few other myths. Some of the myths that have been about Aleppo and Syria in general have been that the Syrian government and army are starving the population. Again, I refer to testimonies of people, even people I met with in November. I met with a family of displaced people from El Halak, which is north of Bustan al Pasha, which was an area, both areas occupied by terrorists. At that time, when I met them on November 10th, he told me that they had fled along with about 40 others on about 20 days prior, and that they had tried twice prior to flee, but they were prevented violently so from doing so by the terrorists that inhabited those areas. This is the case. These are the testimonies coming out of Aleppo now. People saying, we tried to flee, they wouldn't let us, they shot at us. There are also videos showing people who did manage to flee coming under fire and the Syrian army actually protecting them, acting as human shields. So that's to say that what we've been hearing in the corporate media is not depicting an accurate image of what's happening in Aleppo. The corporate media is saying that the Syrian army is attacking people, and until today, the corporate media is maintaining this, even though the exact opposite is true. I would ask you to follow the voices of people in Syria who, like my colleagues here said, they want you to speak the truth. They're tired of lies. They're very well aware of the lies that our media is purporting and that our human rights groups are purporting. They want an end to the violence. They don't want this war to continue. They didn't ask for this war. But as my colleagues stressed, Syria is a sovereign nation. It has the right to fight against terrorism. And we know that 101 of 193 UN member states have sent terrorists to Syria to slaughter and destroy. So Syria is fighting a war against terrorism. It's winning in Aleppo. And hopefully either the terrorists will accept a deal to be transported out of Aleppo. Hopefully they will participate in the Musalaha, the reconciliation, will lay down their arms, will take the amnesty offered to them by the government and which has been taken by thousands of former militants. And hopefully, above all, the U.S. will stop supporting terrorism and stop funding terrorism. And hopefully this new bill will take fire, will be supported, and actually it will be impossible to fund and armed mercenaries from FSA, Ahrar al-Sham, Nuruddin Azinki, and all the colors in between, because they're all the same terrorists. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Eva. Very informative. Thank you very much. Now we are open to questions, if there are questions. The gentleman in the back.
Thank you very much. I'm Christopher Ronneberg with the Norwegian newspaper Aftenposten. A question for, or two questions for Ms. Bartlett here. as a journalist, I'm sure you can appreciate getting other impressions than empirical impressions from the ground. When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media, and why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing. How can you justify calling all of us liars?
Sure.
Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you, there are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in Eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in Eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of Eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that there were that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? So that's with with regards to your question on lying Western media. How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The voter turnout was 88%, including people in Lebanon, where I was during the elections in Lebanon, which were actually ran for 2 days, extended hours, people walking for kilometers to reach the embassy, including people who flew from their own countries like mine, which has criminally shut the Syrian embassy so that Syrian people have no rights, and including people within Syria who braved a torrent of terrorist mortars and missiles on election day. And yet, voter turnout rate was something like 88%, I believe, and the election, the results were 78, I believe. I
think Tim Anderson gives you the opposite.
Okay, I might get the turnout wrong. So the results.
74 was the participant.
74 participate, 88. Okay. Anyway, the point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. That's based on elections, based on my own travels. Okay, so that's subjective. But as I said, I've traveled around Syria, talked with people of all faiths, all walks of life, and there are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria and Lebanon. Thank you.
Here comes the helicopter. Second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Bruce Coburn with If I Had a Rocket Launcher. And then we had, before that, we had Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett talking about the lies and deception that the Western media has spread about the conflict in Syria. I'm going to close the show out with the a talk which Canadian writer Stephen Gowans gave in Montreal on May 2nd of this year, when he released his book entitled Washington's Long War on Syria, talking about the history of the Syrian conflict and the forces that led to it. And so I'm going to round out the show with that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Thanks for listening.
So this is a book, is a map of a complex territory that is the conflict in Syria. And a map never captures the territory in all its complexity. It doesn't capture all the contours, all the details of the terrain, all the hills and the valleys. But that's not the purpose of a map. A map, if it's any good, will be simple enough to be easily understood, but complex enough that the terrain becomes intelligible so that you can navigate the territory in all its variegated complexity. So the talk I'm going to give in the next hour, or less, is a map of a map. If the book is a map, a simplification, though a necessary and useful one, this talk will be even more of a simplification. A very rough map of the territory that is the conflict in Syria. But if the talk does its job, it will galvanize you to ask questions about the conflict, the answers to which you may find in the book. So let me begin by saying that while this book is titled Washington's Long War on Syria, the war is more multiform than the title suggests. It's not only a war between Washington and its allies on the one hand, and the government in Damascus and its allies on the other. It's also a civil war that has been going on since the late 1940s between Islamists and secularists, who have very different and ultimately irreconcilable views about how to organize Syrian society. The two major antagonists in this long-running civil war, the secular Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party, whose partisans are in power in Syria and have been since 1963, in other words, the current government, and the Muslim Brotherhood, Syria's premier organization of Sunni political Islam, which is the ideological antecedent of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, though the latter have been influenced by other forms of political Islam as well. I'll step you through an historical timeline of the conflict in Syria with its elements of civil war and interventionist war. In the mid-1950s, Washington conspired with London to purge Arab nationalist and communist influence from Syria. So their target was a triumvirate of Arab nationalist and communist leaders who Washington and London perceived as threatening Western economic interests in the Middle East. Spearheading this effort was a man named Kermit Roosevelt of the famous or infamous Roosevelt family, which gave us two U.S. presidents. Kermit Roosevelt himself is infamous for having engineered the overthrow of Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who committed the grave crime against Western domination of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Roosevelt and the British Intelligence Service, MI6, planned to enlist the help of the Muslim Brothers to overthrow the three men in Damascus they saw as threatening Western economic interests. For various reasons, that scheme was not realized. In the 1960s, the Muslim Brothers led protests, strikes, demonstrations, riots, all kinds of eruptions in Syria under the banner of Islam, or Ba'ath Arab socialism, or to put it another way, Islam or secularism, always in opposition to what the brothers called the government's godless character. In 1967, the Brotherhood declared a holy war against Ba'ath Arab socialists, denouncing them as infidels and enemies of God. In the 1970s, the Brotherhood established an underground paramilitary organization anticipating the so-called rebels of today. The 1970s rebels were trained and armed outside of Syria, just as today's rebels are trained and armed outside of Syria, by Western U.S. Western intelligence services in Jordan and Qatar. The brothers launched a major campaign of urban guerrilla warfare, assassinating Ba'ath Arab socialists, murdering state officials, killing army officers, attacking Syrian government offices, and assaulting Syrian military bases. In 1973, the Ba'ath Arab socialist president of the country, Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, oversaw the drafting of a constitution that promulgated a mission for the Syrian state. The mission would be to foster the unity of the Arab world, to overcome its religious, its sectarian, and other differences, in order to achieve the Arab world's liberation from foreign domination, and to modernize and indigenize the economy. Modernization and indigenization of the economy would be accomplished through planning and public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy, what Washington and others would call socialism. Indeed, in Washington, Assad was denounced as an Arab communist. He wasn't a communist. In fact, he was suspicious of communists, and communists were suspicious of him. But from Washington's perspective, he may as well have been a communist, since his policies had implications for corporate America, which were equal to those of policies that authentic communists would have pursued. In the 1980s, Robert Baer, a CIA officer who spent decades in the Middle East, found that Syria was, quote, the epicenter of Islamic terrorism. Baer wrote, "When I first set foot in Damascus in 1980, I estimated that Assad had maybe 3 or 4 years before he went under. The Muslim Brothers owned the street. The mosque schools were teaching jihad. The mosque public address system blared out a message of hate and revenge. I figured the guy is going to get strung up on a light pole in downtown Damascus along with a whole lot of other people." That was Robert Baer. In 1980, the brothers established the Islamic Front of Syria, whose manifesto declared war without end until Ba'ath Arab socialism, that is, secularism, was exterminated in Syria. By the way, there are three things the Muslim Brothers and other Sunni sectarian political Islamists hate about Ba'ath Arab socialism. They are nationalism, secularism, and socialism. These are ideologies of European origin, foreign to the Muslim world, foreign to the Quran, and therefore foreign to God. Ba'ath Arab socialism, in the view of the Muslim Brothers, represents a foreign and godless implantation in the Muslim world, which must be exterminated. In 1982, the Muslim Brothers seized control of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city. They went on a blood-soaked rampage through the city, attacking police stations, murdering Ba'ath Arab socialists, executing government officials, killing soldiers. Every Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party official in the city was executed, many by decapitation. In the Syrian government operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitaries. Well, likewise, insurgents operating in Syria today have been trained by the CIA and other Western intelligence services in Jordan and Qatar. In the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood established an alliance with other sectarian Sunni political Islamists to form what became known as the National Front for the Salvation of Syria, which perhaps would have been more aptly called the National Front for the Salvation of Syria from Arab Nationalism, Secularism, and Socialism. The front had two goals. The most immediate goal was to assassinate Assad. The longer term and fundamental goal was to establish an Islamic state based on the Quran. Let's jump to 2001. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, a retired U.S. Army General Wesley Clark told a reporter that during a trip to the Pentagon, he learned of plans to attack a number of countries. One was Iraq, which soon after was attacked. Another was Libya, which eventually was attacked, and a third was Syria. There were others, but Syria was among them. In 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil, its regime change hit list.
Okay.
I have someone looking after me. The Axis of Evil. The original members of the Axis of Evil were North Korea, Iraq, and Iran. In 2002, three others were added: Syria, Cuba, and Sudan, I believe. This was Washington's regime change hit list. Washington claimed that Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction and supporting terrorism, the same bogus charges it had leveled at Iraq, also governed by Ba'ath Arab Socialists. And this was leveled at Iraq as a pretext to topple the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government in Baghdad and to privatize an Iraqi economy which Washington denounced as socialist and was indeed, to a large degree, publicly owned and planned. Iraq had combined its oil wealth with public ownership of the economy and government guidance of the economy to produce what one former U.S. State Department had called a golden age. State Department official. He wrote, schools, universities, hospitals, factories, theaters, museums proliferated. Employment became so universal that a labor shortage developed. The same former U.S. State Department official wrote about Gaddafi, that by combining Libya's oil wealth with public ownership of the economy and planning, Gaddafi's government had enabled Libyans to, quote, live beyond the dreams of their fathers and grandfathers. Well, in 2003, following the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, the United States contemplated, this isn't widely recognized, but it's on the public record, it contemplated extending military operations in Iraq to neighboring Syria, but decided its hands were filled with the pacification of Afghanistan and with the pacification of Iraq, and that it would have to achieve its regime change goals by other means. The intention was to impose broad-ranging sanctions on Syria to do what sanctions are always intended to do, destroy economies. Destroy economies so that ordinary people become so miserable that they rise up to overthrow their governments. And the United States, being such a large economy, is able, through very simple measures of economic warfare, to destroy the economies of small countries like Syria. Sanctions are also useful for propaganda purposes. I mean, once you've ruined a country's economy, you can blame its economic difficulties on the fact that the government has, as the Syrian government has done, pursued socialist policies, or what Washington dubs as, or considers, labels socialist policies. The sanctions, as intended, devastated Syria. In October 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy, quote, was buckling under the weight of the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had, quote, forced Syrian officials to stop providing health care, education, and essential services in some parts of the country. By 2016, according to a leaked UN internal document, U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary Syrians and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The Veteran Affairs Corps.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is